We're going to stop the news now and take you live to the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and listen in to a speech by the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. Here we go.
It was said that Hezbollah, some considered that Hezbollah was not actually, did not actually want the opposition to win, to be victorious. For this reason, Hezbollah did not do its utmost and did not do it all its energy. So the allegations were that Hezbollah did not want the opposition to win. For this reason, Hezbollah did not do its best for the opposition to be victorious, because Hezbollah feared or was terrorized of the aftermath of any victory by the opposition in the elections. Now, let me give a clear response to such allegations. These allegations are not true. Not precise, they are not true. Now, regardless of the intentions of the people who make these allegations, if they have good intentions or hostile intentions to create problems between us and our allies in the opposition, regardless of the intentions, this is not true. Hezbollah was really intent on winning the elections. We did our utmost for the opposition to win the elections, and we cooperated with all our allies in the opposition, and we did our best in the cities, in the villages, politically, socially, on all arenas. We did our best and our utmost for the opposition to achieve parliamentary majority. But many, many different reasons prevented this from happening, prevented the opposition from achieving parliamentary majority. And I'm going to speak about these issues in a short time, I do not hide the fact, yes, we believe that winning would bring about responsibilities, because getting parliamentary majority means challenging or facing very big responsibilities. When we achieve parliamentary majority, this means we must keep our promises. We cannot make promises and then when we win the elections forget these promises. When we do make promises, we must implement these promises if we were to achieve victory in the elections, and we would take our responsibility. And from our perspective, responsibility is answering to our holy duty, answering to God before answering to the people on planet Earth. And so for this reason, we do believe that victory means a great responsibility, dangerous, the danger of carrying a great responsibility. And if we were to be victorious as an opposition, yes, we would have faced a very, very big responsibility, but this would not have affected our performance and our seriousness, and we would have dealt with these responsibilities in the appropriate manner. Now, so when the results were announced, we were not affected, because we believe that these elections are just one stage on a long road. It's not the end of the world, not the end of history. Now, if some say we weren't upset by these results, let me be clear. When you play a game of football or any game, a game of chess, for example, always a loser is upset. So whenever we have such a big election, of course we'll be upset by results if we lose. So whoever does these efforts, and when we put up with all of these hardships and go through this long process of preparing for the elections and the results are not as what we expected, it's natural for some side to be sad or upset. But however, this does not mean that we believe we are weak. We do not believe we are weak, because we are still who we are. We are still the same, and nothing has changed for us. This is the first important point which I want to speak about, and I'm going to speak about a few other points. But before that, let me make a general comment. All the issues I'll speak about in this speech do not mean that we do not accept the results of the elections. No, we do accept the results of the elections, but there are certain facts we must clarify and shed light on so that we address these issues. There are some negative repercussions which must be addressed, and there, of course, are some issues which we must build, which we must deal with in a realistic way. So, of course, as I said, we must address this issue in the appropriate manner. And I also must stay calm, because we are witnessing a calm rhetoric in the country. For this reason, we do not want to escalate our rhetoric to maintain the calm atmosphere. And there are many issues I will touch upon tonight, and were it not for the fact that I wanted to maintain the calm rhetoric, I think that if such points were to be displayed, I would have displayed them in a different way, which could have led to a maybe unstable environment. But because, as I said, we have a calm atmosphere now in Lebanon, I'm not going to speak about I'm not going to escalate my rhetoric. Now, during the electoral campaign, before the elections, the other political camp began with a campaign of accusations. Accusations which were directed towards the opposition forces in Lebanon, all of the opposition in Lebanon. Now, these accusations had no truthful basis at all. Unfortunately, it was discovered that the other camp, just for the mere reason that it wanted to get parliamentary majority, it didn't have any moral problem in adopting maneuvers which are based on lies or fabrication or misleading. So this is the least possible rhetoric I can use. I can't use any more calm rhetoric than that. We did not resort to such means during the election campaign. We did not mislead anyone. We did not accuse anyone of lies. We did not depend on lies. And whoever has any information to the contrary, let him display this information. We couldn't even resort to such means, because I even heard that some opposition, step by step, was on the defensive and the other camp took the offensive. We weren't able to use the same way, the same approach, because we have a religious approach, a moral duty, which does not allow us to use illegitimate means in the election campaign. Now, there's another reason which had a very, very big impact. During the election campaign, we spoke about a national partnership, about a national unity government. We spoke about standing side by side and cooperation. This means that in the media, we couldn't have broken all the bridges with the other side. If we wanted to open old files and begin with accusations based on reality and go back to the past, there were many dossiers, many issues which we could have reinvigorated once again. But if we had actually resorted to such means, and then if we had achieved victory in the elections and wanted to put together a national unity government, what would we have said to our supporters? We would have lost our credibility, because the descriptions and the words which we had could have used against the other camp would have prevented us from having a national unity government with them, because we would have shown ourselves as being not credible in front of our supporters. So this is a problem. For this reason, we didn't resort to these means and use this rhetoric against the other camp in their pre-election period. So, yes, the opposition, step by step, was on the defensive, especially in the last few weeks. Before the elections, we went on the defensive against their accusations, because we saw a rain of lies, and we had to use umbrellas against this rain, because the rain of lies was pouring down so hard. Now, before the elections, I spoke about this. For example, the one-third or divide. I'm not going to speak about before June. Now, before June 7th, we heard what they said. But now, in the future, I'd also like to highlight to all Lebanese factions, listen very clearly. We disagree in politics, okay, we can accuse each other politically, we could insult each other even politically, that might also be allowed for. Concerning Hezbollah and its ties with Syria, you can say whatever you want. Our ties with Iran, you could accuse us of being spies for Iran, as being part of an Iranian bloc in between brackets, okay, that's no problem, you can do that, we'll allow that as well. But I'd like to bring your attention to the fact that in Lebanon, in our constitution, we have freedom of religious worship. Is that true or not? Meaning, nobody, whatever religion he belonged to, nobody has the right to insult the freedom of worship, whatever our religion be. When I worship a certain religion, it means I reject the other religions. If not, I would worship the other religion. So this country is based upon respecting religious beliefs, respecting worship. Maybe they forgot this, but let me remind them that the issue of Wilayat al-Faqih and Imam and these kinds of issues, from our perspective, this is part of our religious ideology, our religious beliefs. Insulting these beliefs means insulting our religious beliefs. Whoever wants to begin with a religious discussion or religious argument, we're ready for any religious argument. But it's not right to begin with this religious argument as part of the political accusations in the run-up to the elections. Cultural people, religious figures can hold discussions about this. Yes, we can hold discussions about the prophets, about the messages, about fuqh. What's the aftermath? What's this world? Okay. But it's not right for such issues to be used in the political electoral campaigns. This is part of our religious beliefs. Some could say that not all the Shia believe in this. There are many religions which don't have a consensus. Many, of course, many people from the Shia sect who believe in Wilayat al-Faqih, and some don't. We have other factions and we have other certain sects in one religion who don't have common beliefs, meaning Maronites don't necessarily believe the same as the Orthodox. So very, very respectfully, very clearly, I'd like to call and speak to all media outlets in Lebanon and outside Lebanon. And as I said, the Lebanese constitution also specifies the fact of freedom of worship. I'd like to tell them very clearly, please abstain from insulting our religious beliefs and attack us politically as much as you want, but stay away from the religious beliefs and religious worship. Now, the third main point, which is related to what happened during the elections, when they spoke about what would happen if the opposition wins or gets parliamentary majority. What could happen then? How could the outside world deal with Lebanon if the opposition were to achieve parliamentary majority? They spoke about Gaza, that Lebanon would become a new Gaza. They spoke about Israel waging a new war on Lebanon if the opposition achieved parliamentary majority. After that, the Israelis spoke and Barak began with his threats, and they said that America would reconsider its assistance to Lebanon. They said that some countries in the Persian Gulf would withdraw their money, their budgets from Lebanon, their financial investments from Lebanon. I have a comment towards all of these allegations. If what you said during this period, if what you said is not true, okay, that's fine. That means we can put it in the huge stockpile of lies and fabrications. If it's not true, if what you said is not true. Now, if what you said is true, of course, there's no other option. It's either true or not true. If what you said is not true, as I just said now, it's a lie which will add to the big list of other lies. Now, if what you said is true, what does this mean? This means that America and the West and the outside world and all of the countries which put pressure, do not respect the will of the Lebanese voter, the will of the Lebanese people. For this reason, the outside world put pressure on the Lebanese and terrorized the Lebanese people so that the Lebanese changed their minds and cast their votes for the other party. Of course, many Lebanese did not bow down to this pressure, but there is no doubt that some Lebanese people actually did bow down to this terrorizing, to these pressures. And so, if you want to describe the elections which were held in Lebanon, and many said, how can we hold elections at the time where we have the arms of the resistance and Hezbollah, these arms of terrorizing? This did not happen. The Lebanese elections happened under American and Israeli and Western and Arab terrorizing, not the terrorizing of the arms of the resistance. They imposed options on the Lebanese voter. So the votes of the Lebanese people probably do not reflect the will of all Lebanese. Now, all the people speak about democracy and the will of the people. If the results of the election serve interests of certain states, they salute the results of these elections. If, however, they do not serve their interests, they accuse these elections and these electoral results. Look at what happened, for example, in Gaza. I'm not going to speak about Iran because Iran is an internal situation for the Iranians. So I advise the 14th of March, I advise all of those political forces to leave the Iranian issue aside. I just advise the March 14 forces not to meddle in the Iranian elections issue because they shouldn't intervene in issues they do not understand. Of course, what they are saying, what they are trying to say is as if Ahmadinejad is March 8 and Mir Hossein Mousawi is March 14. This is silly rhetoric. Of course, Obama, I think, was very precise when he spoke. I think he spoke very clearly. Of course, in America, there is no March 8, March 14. People intervene. People, of course, attacked because there are people who are against the Islamic regime. Yesterday, of course, the Supreme Leader said there are certain elements who do not support neither one of the candidates, Ahmadinejad nor Mir Hossein Mousawi, who were responsible for the violence. But 40 million Iranians, almost 40 million Iranians went to cast their votes under the auspices of the Wali al-Faqih. Where can we see such a display in the whole world? Where can we see presidential elections where we have a turnout of 85%? Now, yes, this democratic process, of course, was slightly harmed because of the disagreements on the counting of the ballots, but because of the presence of Wilayat al-Faqih in Iran, because of the presence of the Supreme Leader, and because of the vigilance amongst the leaders and amongst the Iranian people, I would like to assure you that Iran will overcome this problem very easily, God willing. And anyone who makes comments and anyone who is building their vote, their hopes, I told them their hopes will not achieve anything, meaning here the hopes of overthrowing an Islamic regime. So the third main point is the issue of Lebanese expatriates who came to participate in Lebanon's elections. Now, of course, concerning the expatriates, of course, what I want to accuse the political process, I must not accuse everyone. So when I make these accusations, I don't mean all expatriates. Of course, the expatriates who came to cast their votes played a decisive role in some electoral districts when it comes to the results. We say that, yes, any Lebanese expatriate who lives outside Lebanon, even if he had not come to Lebanon for 40 or 50 years, never took part in the pains and the sufferings of Lebanon, but because he has a Lebanese citizenship, according to the law, it's his right to take part in these elections. We can't say the contrary. And we support the right of the expatriates to take part and to come and cast their votes in the ballot boxes. And nobody in the opposition nor in the majority in any electoral district, nobody can insult the expatriates and show them in a very, very inappropriate or ugly picture. They are Lebanese people and it's their legal right, and they have their convictions. They came to express their opinions and took part in the elections. Now, it's very natural when we speak about the issue of expatriates, it's very clear that tens of thousands of expatriates took part in these elections. Or we can say that they were called on to participate in the elections, especially in the very, very hard-fought districts, which witnessed a very, very difficult, tight challenge. Now, I'm going to speak about the electoral district of Zahle, because Zahle had the decisive results. Were it not for Zahle, we would have had an equal distribution, 64-64 for each team in the 128-member parliament. So the other political camp focused on the electoral district of Zahle. Even before Zahle, we had a ceremony for the expatriates, and the March 14 candidates stood, and one of the March 14 MPs said, "I thank you very much. Were it not for your participation, we wouldn't have achieved victory in this electoral district of Zahle." So the discussion here is not about the right of the expatriate to take part in the elections. The comment I want to make is that there weren't equal chances for the opposition and March 14. The opposition also brought expatriates and March 14 did, but the chances were not equal. First of all, financially, there's no comparison whatsoever. If you want to spend money to bring expatriates from the outside and they want to spend money, there's no comparison. Let's put aside the legal perspective, because does the law allow spending money for expatriates or not? There is no doubt what was said in Newsweek and other media about $750 million being spent. Yes, the facts point out to this. $750 million. This money was used to bring expatriates to take part in the elections in Lebanon. Let me here make a joke, if you allow me. If the issue was so, you could have given us this $750 million and we could have given you the majority. We could have used this $750 million to pay compensations, to give services for certain needy areas, and then we could have decided how we could have completed our political process with you. But yes, huge sums of money were used. So financially, they did their utmost for the expatriates. Another important issue is the countries where the expatriates live in. Certain countries facilitated the expatriates coming to Lebanon. But from us, the expatriates which we want to give, we were under pressures for the expatriates which we wanted to bring from the outside. So concerning the expatriates, it's their right to come and participate in the elections. But as I said, there were not equal chances from the expatriates from our side and the expatriates from the side of the other political camp. Now, if we want to continue with this process in future elections, expatriates coming to participate, we must hold consultations so that there would be equal chances of participation of expatriates. Now, concerning financial spending, the financial perspective, during the last few months, we have a law actually in Lebanon concerning electoral spending, but we had huge amounts being spent. Media, services, building schools, hospitals, etc., etc. Now, I don't want to highlight this a lot because I think this is good for the people. I think people wish that every year we'd have elections so that those political figures would build schools and build hospitals and pay wages and build roads. So for this reason, I'm not going to highlight this, because this actually serves the people, although it's for electoral purposes. But what is dangerous, what is insulting, what is just plain bad, which really, of course, leads to expressing doubts in the results of the elections, is buying votes. They're saying, take money for this vote. Put your convictions aside. Just put your own ideas aside until the 8th of June. On June the 7th, just lend us your political convictions. Take this money and elect us. This is something which is actually cast doubt on the results of the elections. There is no doubt that in many electoral districts this happened. Votes were bought. And I want to take the example of Zahle, because Zahle changed the whole situation. We have eyewitnesses. You know, I never make any accusations before I am sure of what happened. We have eyewitnesses who said $2,000 or $3,000 were paid for one vote. And the closer we approached to the time of closing ballot stations, the number, the price paid increased more than 3,000. There were people who supported the opposition in Zahle, told us, don't even elect March 14, but give us your ID card, meaning don't elect anyone, abstain from voting, and here's $500 just to abstain from voting. So they paid money to buy votes for their camp, and they even paid money for people to abstain from voting, people who actually had decided to vote for the opposition. So does this reflect the will of the people? If we took the same approach, if we told people, we don't have money, we don't have any money to give you, we won't pay you any money for elections, you can elect in whichever way you want. If this approach had been taken, we wouldn't have known what the results would be. So, as I said, this does not mean we don't accept the results of the elections. I'm just expressing our reservations. And this actually casts doubts on the legitimacy of these elections. But at the same time, all of this does not mean we do not accept the results of the elections. We will not wage any strikes or sit-ins. We will not block any roads. We will not stage any protests. We will not actually ruin the calm in the country now. But what I'm just doing is expressing our reservations. The fifth point I'd like to focus on is the sectarian issue, the confessional issue. I'm going very quickly. Usually I speak slower, but I want to go and speak about all the issues in the least possible period of time. Now, there is no doubt that the sectarian incitement and the racial incitement had a big impact during the elections, in the period before the elections, and even after the elections, this rhetoric, this approach is still continuing. If you want my own perspective, the financial issue, the issue of buying votes, the whole financial issue is not as dangerous as this issue, as the issue of sectarian incitement. Even political accusations is not as dangerous as religious sectarian incitement. The most dangerous issue, the most dangerous issue we have in this country is sectarian incitement, because those who cast their votes sell their votes and cast their votes for the other side. Political disagreements do lead to wounds, but political meetings can seal these wounds. But religious and sectarian and racial incitement opens historic wounds, and it's very difficult to seal these wounds, and this takes us to blind confrontation, which could have unexpected consequences. And so here I want everyone to hear the siren of danger, the alarm of danger. From our perspective, whoever has any reservations towards us, whoever believes that we have a racial or sectarian rhetoric, let this person come and talk to us and complain. If we do in fact have such a rhetoric, we are ready to apologize and to correct our rhetoric. But I know we never had such a rhetoric. And not just because of our commitment, let me also speak in a pragmatic way. Never did we need to use such a rhetoric, because we are not weak. We are not weak to use racial rhetoric and to use sectarian incitement. But yes, we did hear sectarian incitement before, during, and after the elections. The two religious groups which were attacked and which were accused during this sectarian incitement approach. The two religions were the Shia in Lebanon and the Armenians. The Shia and the Armenians, I repeat. The Armenians were attacked because of the political choices they made. At one time, they said the Armenians are a foreign group in Lebanon, not Lebanese, but foreigners living in Lebanon. But the Armenians who were nationalized 100 years ago or more, they expressed doubts about their Lebanese identity. But if we have others who were nationalized 10 years ago or 12 years ago, if they cast their votes for the other group, they consider them as normal Lebanese. So I think here you can see the racist approach. Why do we express doubts about the identity of the Armenians and don't express doubts about others who were nationalized 10 years ago? Now, opening this door is very dangerous. Then they would accuse the Kurds in the same way, and this will make us look at the religious, or the, sorry, the national identity of the others. Who is the Turkish, the Turkman, the Persian, etc., etc. Amaziki. So, this is rude and shameful, actually, to open such doors. Now, then they even said that the Armenians aren't even Christian. When they sit down and want to calculate the Christian representation, they don't count Armenians. They speak as if the Armenians are not Christians. It's not to my knowledge that Armenians are Muslims. I believe they're Orthodox, they're Christians. Unfortunately, the Armenians during the elections and still until today, the Armenians are still being verbally attacked, are subject to this racial campaign. Whatever be the Armenians' political choice, their political choice must be respected. We can't behave in the way whereby if they elect us, they are partners in the state. When they don't elect us, they are foreigners. I spoke about the Armenians before, the Shia, because I think speaking about the Armenians is a little more easier. Concerning the Shia, I want to speak about the Shia in Lebanon. Now, during these elections in Lebanon, we saw a lot of incitement. We have some clear incitement. We have some incitement behind the scenes. The incitement was if the opposition wins, then the Shia would control Lebanon. Now, this was said in public, in certain sessions, private sessions, in articles, in political rhetoric. Of course, they said it under disguise, an Islamic state under Hezbollah with Wilayat al-Faqih, the state of the weapons of the resistance, or that if the opposition wins, General Aoun will not control Lebanon, nor this person, nor that person would control Lebanon, but Sayyid Hassan would control Lebanon. This is what was said. They used to tell the people, look, listen, if the opposition wins, it means the Shia would control Lebanon. Now, these are lies and fabrications. I can't use a less harsh word than lies. A fabrication of the truth and the misleading of the public opinion. What we said before is that all we want as Shia is to be partners in this country. We are a sect which was previously neglected in Lebanon. The Shia were neglected previously in Lebanon. The only thing we want is to be partners in this country, and we believe in the uniqueness of Lebanon. We believe in the diversity of Lebanon. We have no problem in speaking about diversity. And we believe that no single religious sect can control Lebanon by itself. No single faction, no single alliance or camp can control Lebanon. Whatever be the strength of any group. No group by itself can control Lebanon. Lebanon can only be controlled in partnership between all its different factions, all its different camps. This is something which we recognize. Any rhetoric to the contrary is misleading. But the insulting, the insults began when they spoke about the Shia bloc, the Shia vote. They said that this MP was victorious because of the Shia vote. Is this shameful? I even read in one of the Lebanese newspapers yesterday, I don't know what this writer meant, what this person who wrote this article meant, but he spoke about the Iranian elections, and he actually drew a picture of a Lebanese sheikh pointing to Ahmadinejad saying he won with the Shia votes. I really didn't understand what was meant. And he then spoke about the Shia bloc. This is really insulting, as if these Shia, let me be very clear, as if these Shia don't think, as if they have no care for anyone else, they don't listen, they don't discuss, are clearly close-minded. When you told them go and vote for this list, they just go and vote for it. Meaning that these Shia are closed, narrow-minded people who can be used in any way we want to use them. Of course, in the newspaper you can read such comments. Some politicians are also speaking in the same way, and we don't accept such language. But I want to comment on this issue of the Shia in a few words. First of all, I'd like to remind them all that the Shia in Lebanon are not one political party. That's first of all. In many other religious sects, people are trying to have one unified party representing one religion, meaning the Christians are trying to have all Christians represented in one Christian political party. But Hezbollah or the Amal movement are not alleging that they represent all the Shia. This is true. And we do not allege that we aim to practice hegemony and represent all of the Shia. None of us want to represent all the Shia in Lebanon. Even in the structure of the Shia, when you want to speak about the religious perspective, the fuqh, the historic perspective of the Shia, the Shiites in Lebanon cannot be represented by one party. We are based upon believing different religious leaders having different beliefs, different political trends, not different religious beliefs, but of course going behind or following different religious leaders. We have a political alliance between Hezbollah and the Amal movement, which is based upon mutual respect, mutual cooperation, transparency. But Hezbollah and the Amal movement do not allege that they represent all the Shiites. So there are many Shia in the country who are not with Hezbollah or the Amal. There are Shia in Lebanon who agree with Hezbollah and the Amal movement politically, in the political approach. Now, if you view the Shia as one bloc, this is not because of the sectarian perspective. The Shia are just the same as any other sectarian group. At times they fought against each other, at times they competed against one another in elections, but today, what unifies the Shia, whether they be Hezbollah or the Amal movement or others, other Shia, is the political, the national political choices. That's what unifies the Shia in Lebanon. What do we agree upon? We do not agree upon being hostile towards any Lebanese politician. We agree upon the resistance. We agree that Israel is a total evil, represents total evil. We agree to rejecting hegemony and occupation. We agree on Lebanese sovereignty. We agree on building Lebanon. The Taif agreement. We agree on political partnership, on national partnership. We agree on normal and unique relations with Syria and all the Arab world. We agree on a clear ideological stance towards Palestine, the Palestinian cause, the Palestinian resistance. This is what we agree upon. This is what all the Shia in Lebanon agree on. And today, if we are paying a price, whether we be victorious or not, we are paying a price of these choices. And today, if we were to abandon these choices, you would find that our stance with the Americans and with the whole world would change. The way they view us would change. Because Shia, Lebanon, because they were unified towards these choices, towards all these issues which I just mentioned, because of this, they went to the elections in 2009 to represent or to express their convictions. So nobody bought their votes, and they did not give their votes because of money, and nobody was able to buy them. And I'm going to speak about some numbers in a few moments. They were not subject to the terrorizing rhetoric of Barak, who said that voting for Hezbollah would put all of Lebanon under the danger or under the threat of the Israeli army. This does mean that all the Lebanese were subject to threats, but especially the Shia in the south and the Bekaa and southern Beirut, the areas which were subject to the harshest bombings in the July 2006 war. But the Shia answered Barak and said, just go away. That was the answer of the Shias to Barak. The Shia voter came and cast his votes, not because it was part of a Shia bloc, but because the Shia voter wanted to express his will, express his convictions. We didn't even say it was a religious duty to go ahead and participate in the elections. The only time we said it was a religious duty to take part in the legislative elections was in 2005, for one reason, because not taking part could have led to chaos in Lebanon. So to prevent chaos in Lebanon, we said that taking part in elections in 2005 was a religious duty. The only time we said it was a religious duty was when we actually had an alliance with the other camp. In 2005, we had an alliance with members of the March 14 movement. Now, I want to speak pragmatically as well. These people did not even need us to say it's a religious duty, because their vigilance, their will, their belief that we were living a very dangerous stage was enough for them to go to the ballot stations and cast their votes. So we didn't even need to say it was a religious duty to cast your votes, because they were going anyway. The Shia went to the ballot stations, went to the ballot boxes, not because there was sectarian incitement, not because there was religious duty, but because they knew that if the opposition won, how good this could be for Lebanon. This would have good repercussions for Lebanon. They also believed that there were allies who stood with us in the July 2006 war. And now, in addition, of course, to the political alliance, now it's time for us to express our thanks to them, to those who stood side by side with us. If not, what does it mean to have political presence in the north, in other places? Of course, this is reference to the political alliance with Michel Aoun. Now, there is another thing which is also very important. I believe that there are many non-Shia voters, Muslims and Christians, who also gave the same message. And this was also very important. But because I'm speaking about the Shia, let me continue about the Shia. The Shia were expressing their mood as well. After the July 2006 war, we heard on the media what I call the black chambers, which distributes to all the media outlets. The media outlets said after the July 2006 war, the Shia mood is changing, and the Shia in Lebanon are sick and tired of resistance, for example, and the choice of resistance has been imposed on them by terrorizing, by money, by weapons, etc., etc. This is what was said. This rhetoric is what we heard. Even the spies who were arrested said that during the July 2006 war and after the July 2006 war, The information which they were trying to gather was the mood, the popular mood, the Shia mood, meaning what are the people in the south saying, what are the people in southern Beirut saying, the people in the Biqa, what's their position towards the resistance? The Israelis wanted to know this. What's the mood of the Shia? And I'd like to tell you, one of the most important aims concerning the destruction of the factories, concerning the destruction of the houses, one of the most important aims of the killings of the women and children, our women and children, this harsh, brutal campaign by Israel during the July 2006 war, one of the aims of this was to attack the vigilance and the mood of the Lebanese, and especially the Shia, especially the Shia. The Shia, on the June 7th elections, went to the ballot stations and stood in long lines, and even in the districts which were known to be pro-Hezbollah, which were known to have a very, very high turnout, a high popularity for Hezbollah, where they were sure that Hezbollah would win, regardless of their votes, they voted to tell Barak and Begin and Netanyahu that their hearts and blood and their religion is still resistance, is still pro-resistance. This was a clear message they were sending. This was a strong message sent by those who lost their women and children in the July 2006 war. This was a message sent by those whose houses were destroyed, whose houses are still destroyed and not built until today. This was a message sent by 1,200,000 people who were forced to flee their homes in the July 2006 war. Their message was that demolishing houses and killing cannot separate us from the resistance, because the resistance is not a gang or a party which came from Zimbabwe. The resistance is us. The resistance is us. The elderly, the women, the children, the workers, the laborers, the teachers, the students, the farmers. We are the ones who created this resistance, and we will not, of course, abandon the resistance, and nobody imposed on us this resistance. Resistance is us, and we are the resistance. This is our choice, a choice of our fathers, our grandfathers, our sons. This is the message which you all gave on June the 7th, a clear message which you gave to the whole world. And today, it's very good what we hear about the resistance and about the arms of the resistance. We are hearing from certain politicians that the arms of the resistance should be discussed on the national table, on the table of national dialogue. This is good. This is good rhetoric, what we're hearing from some politicians. And I sincerely hope that this will continue. But we are ready to listen. We are ready to discuss. But I'd like to say to you, to the Lebanese, to the whole world, to those who are speaking about guarantees or about strength, I want to speak to you, you who are sitting in front of me, and to all your brothers and your sisters, Shia, and those others from other religious sects who supported and protected the resistance. The guarantee is you. You are the guarantees. So, after the announcement of the results of the Lebanese elections, I was very clear. Nobody should be worried about the resistance. Nobody should be worried as the resistance. As long as you own the resistance, as long as you built the resistance, as long as you are the flesh, blood and bones and brain and heart of resistance, then there is nothing to worry about the resistance in Lebanon. So this is the current atmosphere. When those Shia who you mentioned and named as a Shia bloc, when they went to the battle stations, they had these ideas in their minds. Resistance, that's what they agree upon, resistance. Look at the other side. In the recent months, certain people said they represent groups in the Shia and that the Amal movement and Hezbollah always have controlled the Shia by money and by other means. Give us money and see what would happen. One person, one Shia, received $40 to $50 million. He spent this money in South Lebanon just in a period of months. He even employed people. Even those people who he used didn't vote for him. In the electoral district which he was a candidate, he got 734 votes only. 734 votes. But the candidates of Hezbollah and the Amal movement got 36,000 and 37,000 Shia votes. The $40-50 million did not even buy this person 1,000 votes. They bought him 750, not even 750 votes. As I told you, 734 votes. So those who are going to certain Arab countries and tells them, give us money, why don't you use this money in other places? Because they don't benefit you here. Why? Because there is a mood. This is a Shia mood. This Shia mood is based on an ideology, on a culture, not on sectarian fanatics. When everyone has $40 million and comes to South Lebanon and verbally attacks the resistance and verbally attacks the performance of resistance, I would like to tell him, or ask him the question, what is the resistance? The resistance is the people of South Lebanon. They are resistance. So of course, if you use whatever money you can, you won't be able to buy their votes. We have all these people who have martyrs in their families. Are they ready? Are they ready to sell the blood of their martyrs for the sake of one political leader? So concerning the issue of the Shia, I'd like to tell you, this is enough. We've overcome this period. Hundreds of millions of dollars cannot change the mood of any Shia concerning which political side they take. This is concerning those who lost in the elections, although it is my duty also to point out to something important. In some electoral districts, whether it be in the south or in the Biqa, there were certain Shia candidates who were against the Hezbollah and Amal movement, but who did not disagree with us on their resistance, but they disagreed with us in other issues, for example, and this is what made them be against us in the elections. However, I stress they were not against us concerning resistance and the most important issues. Now, let's take the electoral district of Zahle. 16,754 votes, Shia votes. The MP who won in Zahle got only 422 Shia votes. He did not even reach 500 votes, the Shia candidate in Zahle. On the other hand, the opposition candidate got 15,600 Shia votes. In the Western Biqa area, the Shia votes, 12,250. Of course, the person who got the Shia victory, the victory of the Shia seat, got about 800 votes. The opposition candidate got 10,999 votes. Beirut 3 district, the March 14 candidate who won the Shia seat got 1,064 Shia votes out of 17,000 votes. The opposition Shia candidate got 14,182 votes. What does this mean? This means, yes, we have a Shia mood, but I'd like to tell you, this Shia mood is not about fanaticism. It is based upon a political vigilance, a political will, and a historic vigilance for those people who have monitored the whole process throughout the years. And before the Israeli occupation and after the Israeli occupation, they were always in the midst of the struggle, of the hardships, of the developments which happened. And so these numbers I read does not mean that I consider these MPs as victorious. No. Those who were victorious are those who got the highest number of votes. Because in the law, it's not how much votes you got from a certain religious sect. It's how much you get from all sects in the respective electoral district. But as I want to respect the will of the voter in Beirut, in all other electoral districts, we must also respect the will of others. And so for this reason, we must not accuse the Shia or the Arman and speak in this way as a Shia bloc, as if there is fanaticism and the Shia are a bunch of fanatics. So I want to mention another point. I know I've taken a long time, but just give me a bit more. Now, concerning the technical perspective, in the technical perspective, of course, we looked into this issue and we're almost finished. We monitored the issue from the very beginning. I'd like to stress that Hezbollah's people who were there, and by the way, those Hezbollah observers, if we could say, were not only from Hezbollah, they were from the supporters of Hezbollah, from the Shia, Druze, Alawites, Sunnis. So when I speak about Hezbollah being present in different electoral constituencies, it does not mean only Hezbollah members, it means members from the opposition. So we all looked into this, and I'd like to thank all of those who are here in front of me today for taking part in this process. Of course, observers worked in a very, very appropriate way, but we cannot, of course, evaluate this. They must evaluate this political process. Now, concerning the opinion polls, yes, there was the problem in the opinion polls. The opinion polls did not take into consideration the expatriates, what role the expatriates could play. The opinion polls took into consideration the financial buying of votes, but opinion polls or statistics do not take into consideration the expatriates. The expatriates so were not taken into consideration. So in the electoral districts where expatriates did not take part, the statistics were in agreement with the results. The places where we saw differences in statistics or opinion polls with the final results was in the places where we had a high turnout for expatriates. So they took part. Those in Zahle, of course, we monitored those in Zahle, but concerning the others, the expatriates who came to take part in the elections, they weren't taken into consideration. So this must be a lesson we must learn for the future. But to comment on the issue of opinion polls and statistics, I read that where did the opposition make the mistake? It made the mistake because it based its expectations on the opinion polls. Its expectations were based on opinion polls. This is not true. It's true that opinion polls gave us a slight majority. It's true that the opinion polls, which did not take into consideration expatriates, did give the opposition a slight majority. This is true. And the other side, the other team, the other camp was worried, because we did hear from many that the opposition would win. And if you heard in the last 2 weeks before the elections, they energized themselves and money poured in without limits. Why? Because they really feared that we would win. In the last few weeks, the opinion polls gave the opposition an advantage. But I'd like to assure the opposition that we never based our expectations, we never based our energy, our movements on opinion polls. Meaning, we didn't say, let's relax and sit back because opinion polls give us the advantage. We didn't behave in this way at all, no. We always had put the chance that surprises would come up. So for this reason, we never sat back relaxed. So nobody in the opposition punished themselves. I'd like to assure you that the management of the elections in the opposition never relaxed and never based its expectations on opinion polls. Now, if there were some problems, these problems should be addressed. But in general, what I can say is the opposition played an appropriate role. As I said, we must learn the lesson of the future concerning taking into consideration the expatriates. I'd like also to speak about how certain opposition, of course, spoke in a very confident way. Some say the opposition went too far and spoke in a way where it was so confident 100% it would win, and that such a language led many people maybe not even to go to participate in the elections because they were sure the opposition would win. But I'd just like to say this is something normal in the elections. Anywhere in any elections, every side says it would win. Every side says it would win in any upcoming elections. I'd like to confess now, after the opposition spoke in this confident way, after the results were announced, this had a negative effect on the psychological state of our supporters. But did this affect the electoral process and the turnout? And if we had spoken in a different way, would the voters have turned out in high numbers? No, this is not true. Now, another issue is what is said in other subjects concerning going to details, if this is this correct or not. I'd like to tell you that even if we add together all of these mistakes can never change the results of the elections. What changed the results of the elections were the issues which I told you before: expatriates, financial spending, sectarian incitement. These elements were what affected the results. We did make slight, small mistakes, but these mistakes did not lead to a decisive change in the elections. A seventh point, I still have 2 points, seventh and eighth. Two very brief points concerning the results. Concerning the results, the opposition didn't win parliamentary majority. This is true. And of course, the opposition did not have majority before the election, so it didn't achieve its aim. But the opposition didn't lose its stance. The opposition remained an opposition, and it stood and survived against a world war. Money, threats, America, Israel, etc., etc., satellite channels. The opposition stood on its own 2 feet and was able to survive this. And after all these means were used against the opposition, and especially in Mount Lebanon, the people of the opposition must thank God, because the opposition remained and stood firm and was able to survive. The opposition also acted responsibly in a calm manner towards the results of the elections and actually accepted these results. But I'd like to ask a question. I don't want to accuse, but Had we been victorious, had the opposition achieved parliamentary majority, how would the other side have reacted? How would the world have reacted? This is something which shows that we are more democratic and that we take any loss in good spirits. We were tested, we survived this test. Let's see when the other side loses how they would react. Now, the opposition has also proven its presence in all areas. We spoke about the Shia, Christians as well. And of course, you know, the tight contests were in Christian areas. And the Christians show that Christian opposition figures still have their popularity as well. Druze and Sunnis also. We had Druze and Sunnis from the opposition who still have appropriate stances and popularity, especially if we look at certain Sunni districts where there was a tight battle, and we find that the figures of the Sunni opposition, the number of votes they got, at times reached one-third or at times one-half of the votes of the respective religious sect of the Sunnis, for example. This is something very good which could be built upon. And so the opposition does have popularity in the country which we can build upon to continue and to serve the country which we allied ourselves with each other for the sake of. And now maybe on Monday I spoke about this and I said we must study and look who has the parliamentary majority and who has the popular majority. Of course, many polls were conducted about the parliamentary majority and the popular majority, but I'd like to assure you, whatever may be the calculations, whatever may be the multiplication or divisions, I'd like to tell you with 100% certainty that the results of the parliamentary elections show that the opposition is the popular majority in Lebanon. Not the parliamentary majority, but the popular majority in Lebanon. They are the parliamentary majority, yes. According to the Lebanese electoral law, yes. March 14 does have parliamentary majority. But we have popular majority. The opposition has a popular majority. Maybe this doesn't have value in the parliament, but it does have moral importance. It does have political value when people want to speak about the will of the Lebanese people. No, allow me. We cannot say that parliamentary majority means that the Lebanese people as a people have made their choice with March 14, because the electoral law divides the country and the electoral law in Lebanon does not represent a popular will. So this popular majority has a high value, high importance, even when it comes to political partnership. The eighth point, which is the last, concerning the upcoming stage. Of course, I'm going to read them very clearly. Guidelines. From our perspective as Hezbollah, We always believe it is of the utmost importance to continue our alliance with other members of the opposition, and this alliance and these ties will continue whatever be the stance of these opposition parties in the future. Those political factions in the opposition are our allies, and we will stay loyal to these allies, and we will stay side by side with these allies. And whatever else is said, whatever analysis, whatever guarantees, this is all under such a ceiling. Now, concerning the elections of the parliament speaker, of course, the head of the Hezbollah parliamentary bloc said this before, our candidate for being in the post of Parliament Speaker is Nabih Birri, who has been a Parliament Speaker for a long time. And it is the right of the Lebanese majority, of the parliamentary majority, to name the Parliament Speaker. And our participation, Hezbollah, in the government, depends on what we hear from the other side, from what we hear from other politicians. And I do not want to behave preemptively. I want to maintain the calm in the region, in the country. So we will call on the parliamentary majority to implement their promises. During the electoral campaign, they made promises concerning reforms, finance, economy, growth. They spoke about many important issues. One of the most important duties of the Hezbollah parliamentary bloc, and one of the most important duties of Hezbollah's MPs, is to always call on the parliamentary majority to live up to their promises during the election campaign. And we will also live up to our promises. The promises we made before the elections, whether we be part of the government or not, we will do our best to implement our promises as much as we can, God willing. We will continue with our allies. We will continue to look into what happened during the election time, especially in the electoral district of Zahle, MP Elie Skaf. We will always look into all these issues about the legalities of what happened in the election process in Gaza concerning the table of national dialogue. Before the elections, we said, and we will not change, we said that we will continue participating in the table of national dialogue. We want to ask the question, however, how will the table, what form will this national dialogue table take? And I hope that the arms of the resistance, just for the political sake and for the reputation of the country in front of Israel, I hope that the arms of the resistance, I hope that this issue goes out of the political deliberations. And during this period and in the next government, whether we be part of this government or not, and even on the table of national dialogue, we will call for a Lebanese national response to Netanyahu's speech. We will call on a response to this speech which cancels out Palestine, which cancels about Palestinian refugees, which cancels out Arab dignity. This needs a clear approach for a response. It's not enough for me to speak a few words or for someone to hold a press conference. It's a very, very serious, dangerous issue. Before the elections, when some spoke about refugees, they said this is just fake talk. But Netanyahu's voice, Netanyahu's speech was very clear. And Obama said it was a good speech, it was a step in the right direction. But it's not a step in the right direction. It's a very, very bad step. The Netanyahu speech uncovered the American trick. They said Obama's coming, he wants to make a settlement. Netanyahu is an extremist, and Obama wants to pressure Netanyahu at the end. This is all we can do. We can't pressure Netanyahu more. So I'd like to tell you very clearly, even those who believe that what's happening is an Israeli-American disagreement, it's not, as some Arabs try to say. There is a plan. One American-Israeli administration, and there is a distribution of roles to trick the Arabs who were tricked time and again. American-Israeli disagreement. We want to call for a national project, a national plot. How do we confront Netanyahu's speech? How do we confront this plan to nationalize Palestinian refugees in Lebanon? At the same time, but we want to give the rights to the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. Nobody must use a racist language when we speak about Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. How do we confront Israel, which performed these military maneuvers, Turning Point 3, Had we not focused on these maneuvers, I think many Lebanese politicians wouldn't have focused on this. And Israel is continuing with these maneuvers. It's always having maneuvers ever since July 2006 until now. And is preparing itself for something we don't know, God knows. Preparing itself for a war whereby it could impose conditions on everyone and get back the reputation of the Israeli army. This could lead to the 1948 Palestinians fleeing, and these refugees or these people could come to Lebanon. What's the response to this? So we need a response. We need to confront this. Let's look at our strong points. Let's look at our advantages. Let's put the rumors aside, and let's see how we can deal with each other to protect our country, which is part of this region which is always subject to dangers, always subject to real security earthquakes. And I'd like to speak to you, all of you. I'd like to speak to all of the brothers and sisters in all of Lebanon, the West, I'm sorry, the Beqa region, the South, to everyone, to all our supporters, to the supporters of the resistance, to the supporters of the Lebanese opposition. From the bottom of my heart, I'd like to thank you. I'd like to thank you. I'd like to express my appreciation. And I cannot find the words to express my thanks and my sympathy. On Monday night, when I spoke about the results and accepting the results, some said I should have spoken to the people. I told them I didn't find the appropriate words to use, the words which are equal to the sacrifices, to the sympathy of those people. People are upset because of the results. Yes, of course they're upset because they're concerned with the future of a country, with the dignity of their country. And those who are responsible, who show this responsibility and sacrifice with this great responsibility, I, for one, cannot find the appropriate words to express my thanks. This is not simple talk, this is the truth. Even now, before, when I was preparing the speech, now when I'm speaking, I was just looking to find the suitable words. And maybe some of the comments which we used on the 22nd of August after the victory against Israel in 2006, maybe now this is also a clear survival, a political survival. For this reason, maybe I'm incapable of finding the words to use. You are the most dignified, most cleansed people. I'd like to thank all of the expatriates who came with their own financial benefit, or who came with their own money. I'd like to thank all of the elderly, the sons, the children who stood under the sun, under the blazing sun, to cast their votes. I'd like to thank everyone. I'd especially like to thank my brother Sheikh Naim Qasim, the Deputy Secretary General of Hezbollah, who was in charge of Hezbollah's electoral process. I'd like to thank all of those who helped him in the elections. I'd like to thank all of them. I'd like to thank the MPs who were victorious. I'd like to thank those MPs who will be part of the Hezbollah parliamentary bloc, which will reflect your will and your convictions and your options, your choices. I'd like to thank all of my brothers who were part of the Hezbollah bloc and who will no longer be part of the Hezbollah parliamentary bloc. I'd like to say that everyone did their best. Everyone stood awake in the night. But as we said before, what we do is our duty. We do what we can, and we accept the results, whatever they may be. We accept these results, we build on these results, and we continue on the road, and the road is open, the road is full of hope, and I hope we can achieve a lot. Good luck to you. May God bless you. Thank you. And assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Well, that was the Secretary General of the Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah.